in order to have it record. I got a thoughtful email from a student after the last lecture saying that she felt the amount of time I spent discussing the Wisconsin protest wasn't time well spent at this point in the semester, not because of any political objection, but just because this is the end of the semester, you're all in kind of exam preparation mode, and the amount of time I spent really wasn't relevant to the exam, that, you know, that I'm not going to ask you questions about the Wisconsin protests, or certainly not about why I found it a moving experience to testify at the assembly hearings. That won't be on the exam, I can guarantee it. So you can forget about it. Let it drift from your memory if you wish. That reflects an interesting perpetual tension that as a professor I face. I thought I would just comment on that just very briefly. If I could snap my fingers and have the perfect world in which my passions and interests and commitments around these ideas could be shared with you, there would be no grades. Or I would just give you all A's at the beginning of a class and say, forget about grades, worry about ideas. That's really how I feel about education. That you should only be taking, in the ideal world, you'd only be taking classes because you actually want to sharpen your intellectual capacities, learn about things, argue with the professor or learn from the professor and from your fellow students, that would be the point of this. And I try to act as if that was the world in which I lived as much as possible. So I devote my energies in thinking about what to present and how to do a class much more in terms of how can I convey these ideas in a way that you'll actually hopefully learn something in the class. And I tend to not place a lot of attention on the practical matters of evaluation and grades, which I think fundamentally interfere with the process of dialogue and conversation and communication that's at the heart of what education should be. Of course, that isn't the world we live in. I fully recognize that grades matter to you. You are going to be taking an exam. And it's a perfectly legitimate concern on your part whether the material being presented is or is not going to help you do as well as you would like in the course. So there are trade-offs. There's an inherent tension between these two modes. That tension is going to be played out again in this lecture because there will certainly be some things that I'll be discussing and sharing with you as this final wrap-up session that I can guarantee will not be on the exam. I don't think there's a way to resolve the tension. It's like many contradictions in the way we want to live our lives. You just have to work for some kind of balance and just cope with the trade-offs and sometimes just muddle through rather than come up with some optimal solution. All right, so with that as a kind of prologue, let's quickly shift to the exam, right? There's now practical matters, what this exam is going to be like. It's basically like the others. You've taken two exams on this format, so there shouldn't be any surprises about the character of the exam itself. There will be 8 short answer questions, very much of the sort you've been having on the previous ones, on democracy, on the democracy part of the book, this last chunk of the course. There'll be fewer multiple choices about statistics because this part of the course just had less data presented. And if you look through the book and the slides, you'll see there's not that many statistics for me to hit you over the head with. So the statistics part will be easier, not because the data's simpler, but because there's just less of it for you to worry about. There'll only be 4 multiple choice questions about statistics from the democracy part of the readings. Each of those will be worth 1 point, so it's going to have less weight in this exam than in the other exams. There will, however, be 6 multiple choice questions about ideas and themes from the first part of the course. Those will be multiple choice rather than additional short answer questions. and they'll be each worth 2 points. They're not about statistics, they're about ideas, and they will constitute 20% of the total points in the grade, in the exam. The grading scheme will be pretty much like on the previous one. That is, I don't remember exactly what the brackets were, but it was basically 90 and above was an A, and working down the scale. And as I said after the first exam, if the first exam was much worse than the second exam, it will get very little weight in the final grade. I don't make a similar adjustment between the second and the third exam. Those will be given equal weight. Well, the final exam is 40% of the total, a little bit more because it has those extra questions. The reason for downplaying the first exam is because for many of you, particularly for people who are freshmen, this will be the first or one of the very first exams you've taken. You didn't quite know how the exam was going to be, and it's a way for people to have recovered from a disastrous first effort without having that undercut the rest of the semester. I'd like to now restart your postpone. I don't like getting all these instructions from my computer about what I should be doing. I want to begin this lecture by showing you a short video called The Chess Game. This was a semester project that I did when I was an undergraduate. So when I was finishing my senior year in college, spring of 1968, ancient history, prehistory, for nearly, as far as I can tell, for everybody but one person in the class, prehistory, I took a course in animation, and I made this film called The Chess Game. The film, it turns out, I was already a budding sociologist, and this film tells a sociological story. I didn't realize at the time, however, that the basic ideas of this animated film are actually central to the underlying themes of a course that I would be teaching 44 years later. So, I want to share The Chess Game with you, and then I'll tell you why this is relevant. See if I have to turn up the... Thank you. Well, that was 44 years ago. Let me get back to the PowerPoints. The message of the film might be a little obscure. The idea that I was trying to convey is that the pawns thought that they could escape from the very destructive world in which they lived, where they were cannon fodder in this terrible chess game. It was actually a lousy chess game. You don't have a chess game in which the only pieces that get taken practically are pawns. But the pawns revolt. They think they can change the world just by getting rid of the ruling elite. And they try to dance a square dance of Virginia Reel on the chessboard. But in the end, the game just starts again, except that the roles are reversed. The pawns are on the back rank, and the former elites are now the pawns. The mistake that the pawns made was that they didn't get rid of the board. So the metaphor was that the chessboard represents the underlying social structure that produces the game. The rules of the game that they tried to play and they tried to change, they couldn't change because they remind me 4 hours from now. How about that? The rules of the game were generated by the underlying social structure. You can't just change rules without changing the underlying institutions. And the chessboard was meant to be a metaphor for that. You can't dance a square dance on a chessboard is the kind of motto, if you will, of the film. Well, that was a little obscure, I think. I've shown this, at the time I showed it in a number of places. I was in Paris and showed it at a student kind of cultural center. This is in the heat of 1968. This is just after the May events in Paris. Some of you may know about when Paris was turned upside down by basically a student-led revolt against the system as a whole, against the structures of power and authority. So I presented this at a student cultural center later that summer, and I was severely attacked for saying that you couldn't do anything to make the world better, that revolutions are doomed to fail, that there's a French expression, la plus ça change, le plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they're just the same. And I was accused of that kind of conservative philosophy. Whereas in fact, the film is meant to be a very sociological account of what it takes to change the world, which is you have to change the underlying social structure. Well, that's, I think, in one sense, a big theme of the course as a whole. The course has been devoted to trying to figure out what kind of a game we're playing. What are the rules, and how do they affect people's lives in different ways? We began the semester 15 weeks ago by asking the question, what kind of society is this? And over the subsequent 15 weeks of the semester, I've tried to provide at least partial answers to that question. I think for many of you, perhaps my answers may seem a little depressing, for I've emphasized the ways in which our institutions really fail to live up to our values, the values which these institutions are supposed to represent. Capitalism and markets are supposed to promote freedom and efficiency. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're heralded for. That's how the triumphant praise of capitalism, what is pronounced. Capitalism promotes freedom, efficiency, and prosperity. But because of the specific ways our capitalist institutions are organized, the economy generates persistent and significant damaging forms of inefficiency, not efficiency, and constraints on freedom. Most Americans, virtually all Americans, believe in fairness, especially understood as equal opportunity. But our institutions perpetuate, and in some cases have deepened, poverty and forms of inequality that are absolutely incompatible with virtually any standard of fairness, not just my more radical standards. Virtually every standard of fairness is violated by the forms of poverty and inequality which are in practice generated by the way our economic institutions are organized. Our political institutions are defended on the grounds of democracy. And yet the way our political institutions are organized, as we've seen in the last few weeks, has resulted in concentrations of power and a weakening of democratic vitality, not a strengthening. So taken together, I think these observations, if you agree with them, if you feel that this has been a cogent presentation of where these problems lie, taken together, I think they can be described as the tragedy of our era. The deep and widening gap between the ways American society could promote human flourishing and the direction our society is taking. Childhood poverty in a land of poverty is one thing. Childhood poverty in a land of plenty is another. The way I would put this problem of the tragedy of our institutions is that our institutions perpetuate unnecessary forms of human suffering. I personally think this is not a left-wing or a right-wing issue. It's not a secular or a religious issue. This is an affront to virtually everybody's moral instincts. Childhood poverty in a land of plenty. Most people, when they think about it, just find that in tension with their deepest moral values. Many years ago, I took a theology course from a wonderful African-American theologian, Howard Thurman, who had a really interesting perspective on the concept of sin from a Christian point of view. It was a serious advanced theology course that I took. And he described sin as the gap between the way we behave and the way we could behave. It's this gap between potential and actuality. And then he applied that to society as well. He was a progressive person and felt that the moral concerns that are embodied in the idea of sin can also be applied to society. And the gap between the kind of human flourishing that a society has the potential to provide and that it actually provides, that gap represents sin in his perspective. And that's how I basically think of the critique of American institutions. It's not just that they block human flourishing, but they do so in an unnecessary way because we have the potential to create the conditions for much more widespread and universal conditions for human flourishing. Unnecessary suffering. Unnecessary in the sense that our institutions could be otherwise and could avoid it is at the very core of this critical question. That is our past and our present, and the important question is whether it's also our future. Are there reasons for hope, and what would it take to actually have a future that's different from our past? Well, one source of optimism, of at least a certain kind of optimism, comes from a really startling feature of historical development, which is how utterly surprising history can be. This is outlined in the final chapter of the book. I give a list of events and changes that occur within a 15-year period, starting in 1905, which no one at the beginning of the period would have anticipated. These are surprises that people in the historical circumstances would not have anticipated at the beginning of each period. This is in the book. Let me just quickly go through these 15-year periods. 1905 to 1920. You're sitting in 1905 looking into the future. What happens? World War I and the Russian Revolution. 1920 to 1935. From the roaring 20s, with its fantastic economic boom, with an unshakable large Republican majority in the United States government, to the stock market crash and the Great Depression, and then the New Deal, the first major period of intensive institutional reform to deepen the conditions for equality and fairness in the American economy. From 1935 to 1950, World War II, the atomic bomb, the Cold War. From 1950 to 1965, the civil rights movement, the end of segregation in the South, the legal end to centuries of legalized oppression of African Americans in the South, the beginnings of the student movement and the hippies in the 1960s, and the assassination of Kennedy in that 15-year period. From 1965 to 1980, the first defeat of the United States in a war, the mass anti-war movement, the impeachment of Nixon, the sharp move of national politics to the right in both the United States and Britain. Between 1980 and 1995, we're now approaching your era. The collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of communism and the end of the Cold War. I gave lectures in Moscow in 1987. I was invited to give lectures. 1987. It was clearly a period of great change, great transformation. And I asked people over vodka, so they, you know, in private, what they anticipated for the future. Absolutely no one had even the vaguest idea that the entire system was just on the verge of complete and total collapse. They felt there'd be certain kinds of market reforms. They thought it was inconceivable that the Soviet Union as an empire of republics would break up. Within 2 years, it had. Between 1995 and 2010, 9/11, the triumph of the most extreme ideological white right-wing political coalition in modern U.S. history, controlling both the Congress and the executive branch. In that 15-year period, along with the election of Obama, and the longest war in U.S. history, the Iraq War. Or I guess the Afghanistan War is the longest since the Iraq War is officially over. And between 2010 and 2025, well, who knows? If the past is any basis of prediction, what we know is there are going to be things that are going to happen in the next 15 years that are really surprising, that nobody expected. And that can be thought of as a reason for some optimism, as a reason for hope. The reason why it's a reason for hope is that there will be windows of opportunity in which progress can be made or blocked around the issues which we have been discussing this semester. At the heart of those transformations, I would argue, are really two very broad kinds of changes that are needed, which I refer to as extending democracy and deepening democracy. Extending democracy means broadening its scope, bringing more domains of social life under public deliberation of citizens, figuring out how they want to organize their affairs. That's extending to broader scope. And deepening means to enrich the democratic vitality of the process by which decisions over that broader scope get made. What we might think of as possible futures then are possible if we can make significant advances both in extending democracy and in deepening it. So first let me just run down some of the issues for extending democracy. Many of these things we've talked about at one point or another over the semester. I'm trying to bring these threads together into one place. First, extending democracy means redrawing the public-private boundary between democratic regulation and private rights in the market. If you recall from the early discussion of those issues, the distinction between the public and the private is a distinction between the domains of social life that can be legitimately discussed and acted on in a democratic way, that's the public, and the private are the restricted zone of things that our collective decision-making should have nothing to do with, should keep its hands out of. The public and the private, that boundary between the public and private is always contested. It's not a natural boundary. Natural meaning it's somehow just given in nature, that there's some obvious and simple way of drawing a boundary between the two. Now the reason for that, just to remind you of this earlier discussion, the reason why the public-private boundary always has to be negotiated is because our private acts have public consequences. When you act just on your own, there are consequences of what you do that affect other people. And if you believe in the value of self-determination, this core democratic value that people should be able to control their own lives, then if you're doing things that are having effects on other people, they should be party to the decision to do them or not do them, because you're having effects. Well, in practice, it would be a terrible world to live in if every decision that you make that has effects on other people, you have to consult everybody who's affected by it, since virtually everything you do does have effects on other people. So you have to say, okay, yes, there's some effects, but for a big part of what we're calling private, we just want to say, do your own thing, and don't worry about the fact that it affects other people, even if they don't choose those effects. So we are willing to compromise on this problem of self-determination, because we feel that to interfere with individual choices on every instance where they affect other people would just make life too controlled. It would make it too complicated. To use some language of economists, I haven't used this language, this particular bit of language, the transaction costs of actually negotiating all those decisions would be just out of control. So we say, yes, some things are private, you take care of it yourself, and you don't have to ask anybody else. The question is where you draw the boundary, and we've drawn the boundary way on the extreme that allows for private decisions that have massive effects on other people's lives. Massive effects to the extent that it can actually destroy their lives. We allow those to be made on the basis of purely self-interested private decision-making. That's what private ownership in a market and the unregulated aspects of private ownership in the market do. The example that I gave that I think is the kind of poignant example is the decision to close a factory and move it elsewhere because you can maximize your profits if you do so. That decision massively affects the lives of people who are not allowed to participate in the decision. And that is profoundly undemocratic. And it reflects drawing this public-private boundary, in my judgment, way too far on the side of giving power to private actors when their actions should be collectively decided jointly with the other people whose lives are affected. So the first aspect of extending democracy is really to come to terms with this problem and to recognize that the market is not some magic institution where private decisions are made that automatically serve the collective welfare, that private decisions made under private property in a privately organized market produce massive negative externalities and negative effects on other people, and those have to be, or should be, in my judgment, regulated through collective democratic processes. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's necessary if we want to extend democratic life in the United States. A second aspect of extending democracy, which is one that we spent a little bit of time on in the first part of the course, There needs to be a massive public investment in transportation infrastructure. One of the main ways in which our collective fate is structured by the choices available to us is how we get around physically in the world. In a world where public infrastructure for transportation is weak, people have little choice but to opt for private modes of transportation. And in the context of the way this has developed in the United States, private modes of transportation are overwhelmingly centered around the automobile. With respect to a whole range of negative externalities concerning the environment, and particularly and acutely in the course of your lives, global warming, a shift from a private individual transportation system based on fossil fuels to a more public form of transportation based on other energy sources, I think is essential if we are to be able to get any traction on the environmental problems we face. But this involves extending democracy, having the choice of transportation systems be more robustly under public decision-making rather than private decision-making. Public control over energy development. As long as energy development is governed by private profit-maximizing actors, they will opt for energy development that gives them relatively short-term profits. That's what market actors do. You know, that's what they're good at. What they're good at is figuring out how, in the course of some relatively short time horizon, remember that idea, the time horizon, under relatively short time horizons, how to maximize the returns on their investment. Creating a public arena for the development of energy is essential if the time horizons for energy development are to be long-term rather than short-term. And if we are going to save the planet, there is simply no alternative. There is no way for a market with short-term profit-maximizing goals to adopt the energy development strategies necessary for a green future. Extending democracy also involves creating a genuine universal public health care system. We're moving in that direction. I predict, so you can write this down as a prediction I'm making in the end of 2012, I predict that the Obama healthcare reforms will both become popular once they're fully in place, just like Medicare became very popular once it was in place, and that it will be filled with all sorts of negative effects. It's not going to be the solution to these problems. And that's because it relies way too heavily on private profit-maximizing insurance companies. And the profit-maximizing insurance companies are going to constantly undermine the ability of the healthcare reforms to control and contain healthcare costs. That the contradictions of this new system, this new institutional system, at some point in the future will lead to a renewed debate over how to reorganize the insurance side of the new healthcare order, and that moving in the direction of a publicly provided insurance system rather than a profit-maximizing insurance system is at least one possible outcome. But that would involve extending democratic control over the provision of insurance, not merely the rules under which private insurance provides for health care. Extending democracy also implies a renewed emphasis on labor market and workplace regulation. Now we're moving in exactly the opposite direction, to continually reduce the amount of regulation of labor markets and workplaces. The law that was signed yesterday or the day before in Michigan, the so-called right to work law, it's more properly called the right to be a free rider law, in Michigan, reduces the ability for democratic regulation of workplaces. It intensifies competition between individuals, and I think will inevitably weaken the various kinds of protections that workers have achieved in the past. Extending democracy also requires expanding public sector employment. Now that's really off the agenda in the United States today. The current dominant view is that we already have too many public employees, not too few. Public sector employment, I think, however, is absolutely essential for a vibrant democratic society. Not mainly because I think it's a good source of good jobs for people, although that's true, but because there are so many things that need to be done, so many public goods and common problems that need to be solved that simply require people to do them, and the private sector is not going to do it because these are the production of public goods are simply not, with very rare exceptions, are not the profit-maximizing activity of private firms, not in their profit-maximizing interests. A vibrant public sector in health and education and cultural production, cultural services, and other kinds of infrastructure, a vibrant public sector, I think, is absolutely essential for a vibrant society. And that's another aspect of the extending of democracy. And finally, taxation and redistribution is needed to counter the hugely inegalitarian effects of markets. The reason for higher taxation on wealthier people is not simply it's a way of solving budget deficits. That's the main thing that's been discussed in the current matter, is that in order to raise revenues, we have to increase taxes on the richest Americans. That's, of course, part of the issue, but the main issue is that if everyone is to have an equal burden, it's simply unfair for the wealthy to be paying as low taxes as they are. It's a violation of basic ideas of equal sacrifice by citizens for the common good. The sacrifices by citizens for the common good are way disproportionately borne by ordinary and lower income people. Once you recognize this difficult issue that we discussed on the session on taxation, this really difficult issue, that equal burden means that the richer you are, the higher the proportion of your income you have to pay in taxation. That's what creates equal burden. Equal burden is not equal taxes or even equal percentage. Equal burden means equal pain. And equal pain means that the marginal tax rate on the wealthy has to be way, way higher than it is on middle and lower income people. And in the United States, it's only slightly higher, and because of all sorts of tax dodges, often ends up being much less. That is absolutely essential if you have any commitment to the notion of fairness in the way in which we provide for our common goods. All right, that's extending democracy. How many of the things on this list are possible? If I were to be asked the question in the next legislature, I think almost none of this is possible. Possibly there's going to be a little bit of increase in taxes on the wealthy. It looks like that's kind of how things are going. But most of the other things on this list are way off the current political agenda. But who knows? There are surprises, and perhaps in the next 15 years there will be opportunities for extending democracy. But that isn't going to happen unless we can also deepen democracy. That's been one of the big themes of this part of the course, is how our democratic institutions have become enfeebled over time rather than deepened over time. We are a less democratic society today than we were 50 years ago. We are a less democratic society. And I say that in spite of the fact that 50 years ago, or a little more than 50 years ago, because of segregation in the South, we did not have equal voting rights. Now that was a big blot on our democracy, for sure. And in that one respect, democracy has been deepened. The end of segregation was an historic achievement of deepening democracy in the United States. But in almost every other respect, our democracy has become weaker, not stronger. Money plays a bigger role now than it did in the past. Gerrymandering produces more distorted forms of representation now than it did in the past. The disjuncture between our democratic ideals and our democratic practices is greater than certainly any time in my life, with the exception of the end of legalized racial discrimination within democracy. So what does deepening democracy entail? It means striving for true political equality of citizens. And above all, this really means that the background conditions of participation in political life have to be made more equal. The inequality of conditions of life that people have in this society is in and of itself incompatible with equality of citizenship. Now, that doesn't mean that equality of citizenship requires that everybody have absolutely the same income, that economic inequality disappear. No, I'm not. That would be the most radical position, that you can't have political equality unless you have absolute economic equality. I think that's simply not true. You can have political equality without full economic equality, but you can't have political equality with the levels of economic inequality that we have in the United States today. The concentrations of wealth, the degree of disparity between the top few percent of the population and the middle, and especially the disparities between the top and the bottom, are such that there is no way that those inequalities don't impact the capacity of people to participate in political life on equal terms. Beyond simply wanting to reduce economic inequality as a background condition for political equality, as an aspect of deepening democracy, it's absolutely essential to reduce the role of private money in politics. There's a necessity for some kind of serious public financing of democratic processes, especially of elections, but also public subsidies to support a democratic media. The particular ideas that I suggested are only one of many possible ways of thinking this through. For the role of public financing in elections, I suggested this interesting proposal by Bruce Ackerman, a law professor at Yale, the democracy card. He calls it the patriot card. I prefer the term democracy card. The idea that everybody gets a kind of voucher of worth some amount of money. I think he set it at $50. I'd probably set it a bit higher. Everybody gets a certain amount of money in the form of a voucher, which they can spend on politics every year. But any politician who accepts that money is not allowed to accept private money. So you get a competition between public financing and private financing. And the reason why one might expect the public financing aspect could win in that competition is if you put enough money in the public sector, most politicians will not be able to compete effectively by getting private money. And eventually the use of private money could be viewed as kind of unsavory, if the public funding was seen as legitimate. Public funding of elections, significant public funding of elections, spending billions on it, not a few million, a large commitment to the public underwriting of democratic equality in elections is crucial, but also public subsidies for a democratic media of the sort that we discussed in our section on the media. Deepening democracy also requires institutional reforms of the rules of the electoral game. There are many ideas for this, proportional representation, instant runoffs, the reduction of gerrymandering, having districts of congressmen and state representatives set by nonpartisan commissions rather than by legislatures, for example. The end of gerrymandering, particularly when it's being used in such a systematic way, One of the problems is that with computer technologies and current mapping technologies, it's possible to draw boundaries in a very fine way so that you really can pack all of your opponent's voters into a few districts and draw the boundaries so that the districts that have a majority of your party have just a small majority, but that means you get to win lots of districts. That's the essential way that gerrymandering works. Well, it's much easier to do that now with computer technology than it did in previous decades when people basically had maps and they drew lines, hand drew them on the using tabular data. Now the district lines can be drawn extremely finely, and it results in this very big distortion. That has to, if we want to deepen democracy, that's an essential condition. And finally, for deepening democracy, we need to think through new democratic innovations to create new ways for people to meaningfully participate in political activity. Innovative forms of what I call empowered participatory governance. That's the topic that we got a little short-circuited on because of the amount of time I spent on the Wisconsin protest last time. I only went through one example, participatory budgeting, as an example of new forms of participation. But there are other new innovative forms of participation in political life that are being discussed and experimented with. One that I like, which I didn't, again, discuss in the last lecture, but I find it a kind of intriguing one, harkens back to Athenian democracy. You know, Athens is often thought of as the birthplace of the idea of democracy. It's the first polity in the era of civilization, that is where states and communities formed and left written records. It's the first polity of that sort where there was something kind of like a democracy. Now, it was a democracy only for men and only for free men, so that slaves weren't part of it and women weren't part of it. So, you know, it's not close to what we would think of as of equality of citizenship. But what the interesting feature of Athenian democracy is that the legislators were chosen by lot, by randomness, just the way we choose jurors. You just chose your legislatures by a random selection. We do that for juries. There are places in the world which are experimenting with having policy juries as well. Certain kinds of policy decisions, maybe it would be better to have just a random set of citizens make the decision. Now, not in the form of a survey, a random set of citizens that are then gathered together in an assembly, study the matters, hear pros and cons on different issues, and above all, have a chance to talk to each other about it, to deliberate, to discuss the matters. And then for that citizen's policy jury to come up with a solution to whatever the policy issue might be. This has been done, for example, where there are issues around zoning in urban spaces. Zoning decisions are often extremely controversial. Should you allow variances and allow a bar in a residential neighborhood, right? The zoning rules say no. The bar owner wants a variance. If the bar owner has a lot of political clout and goes to the politicians to ask for a variance, the reasons why the zoning rules might change may have nothing to do with what's best for the community. Well, that's why a policy jury to decide certain kinds of decisions might be a good idea. And that's being experimented around the world in certain places, including in the United States. There are some very interesting experiments in having random citizens actually make public policy. Well, there's many other examples. That's the one of the areas of my own research, is looking at these innovations in democratic participation. And if we want to deepen democracy, eventually we have to think about how to do so in a way that directly involves citizens in public policy making and deliberation, not just how do we make elections more democratic. There are thus many possible futures that are contained in the present. I don't know which of these is likely to happen. One possible future is an intensification of the tendencies we have observed in this course. You know, one possible future is a continuing erosion of the affirmative state, a deepening use of military power in the attempt to create a world congenial to what some people think of as American interests. That's a possibility. A continual turn to the market and private corporations to solve pressing problems. That's one possible future, just continuing along the way we have. In many parts of the country, the most rapidly growing kind of housing is the gated community that uses private security forces to guard the perimeter and thus to create an enclave of tranquility rather than to try to transform the broader social problems in the wider world. That's one possible future. But is it the only possible one? Well, I think it's also possible to envision a future in which the destructive effects of markets have been tamed, where poverty and inequality are reduced, where urban spaces are revitalized, and where democracy is deepened. I think that's possible. Do I think it's likely? Well, I like to, maintain a cheerful disposition and act as if I were optimistic. You know, sometimes one feels if one is optimistic, it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. I suppose if I had to put money on the question of which of these possible futures is most likely, pessimism would triumph. But pessimism is pretty easy. Pessimism is a kind of facile answer. It's sort of a knee-jerk thing. Things have been difficult. They're not looking like they're getting any better. Well, it's just extrapolate into the future. Pessimism is easy. Optimism takes work. It takes intellectual work to provide foundations for it. It takes political work to make the optimism come true. And ultimately, I think this depends upon how we, and the we I mean are all of us, respond to the collective surprises that we'll face in the historical future that we encounter. And this is where I think the things we have studied in this class may be of some relevance. Let me just briefly then distill the entire semester into bullet points. You know, these are 12 big ideas from the course. You can frame these, 12 big ideas of the course. These are 12 things I hope you remember, 10 years from now, over a summer barbecue, if you're idly talking to neighbors and somebody raises some idea or issue, one of these 12 ideas might pop into your head and you say, I have this vague memory of something this professor talked about. What do you think about this? All right, 12 ideas. Big themes to remember. What kind of society are we? Big question that we've asked throughout the semester. The U.S. is a hyper-capitalist society. It's extreme on most of the dimensions of capitalism. So we're not a typical capitalism. We're a deviant form of capitalism. We're what I would call hyper-capitalism. And many of the dilemmas and problems which we face come not from simply the fact that we're a capitalist economy, but because of the particular kind of capitalist economy that we have. The U.S. is a hyper-capitalist society. Second big idea about the market. This has been kind of a mantra throughout the semester. Markets are not automatically efficient. They have inherent irrationalities. And it's really important to remember the inherent bit in that statement. It's not just noise. It's not just market imperfections. It's a deep and intrinsic part of the way markets work that they produce irrational outcomes. They're not automatically efficient. They do contribute to efficiency. I'm not rejecting that idea. but how much they contribute to efficiency depends upon how well they are regulated, not how unregulated they might be. Third idea, the market and freedom. Markets both enhance and restrict freedom. It's not a simple equation. If you're a person who really values individual freedom, you have this value of self-determination, and especially on its individualistic face. Remember, self-determination means both democracy and individual freedom. It means both things. Equally, it means both. But if you especially are drawn to the individual freedom aspect of the idea of self-determination, which I think most Americans are, then you cannot be for a free market. That's the irony. The free market is not the best way to enhance individual freedom. It does enhance individual freedom, but it also undercuts it strongly. It turns out that a democratically regulated market is more likely to enhance individual freedom than the unregulated free market is. That's an irony, right? The simple equation says individual freedom equals free markets. Free markets equal individual freedom. A nice symmetry between those, because the word free appears on both sides of the equation. It's simply not true. If you really value individual freedom, the ability to autonomously shape your own destiny, then you should want a democratically regulated market that makes such individual capacity to make choices and act on them possible. That's the third big idea. Fourth big idea. One of our favorite terms and ideas of the semester, the free rider, the prisoner dilemma. These are pervasive issues in contemporary society. Prisoners' dilemmas and free riding problems, the fact that we need certain kinds of public goods and they will not be provided if we just let people provide them as individual contributions, because people will be tempted to be free riders. Free riding affects elections, free riding affects taxation, free riding affects all sorts of things we've discussed. And free riding is a pervasive problem. It's a problem that for which there are solutions, but the solutions don't happen without paying attention. The fifth big idea connects a bunch of the ones we've already been talking about. And this is the specific problem of the relationship of the market to prisoners' dilemmas, or the markets to free riding. You know, the free rider and prisoner dilemma are very closely connected ideas. The prisoner's dilemma is this nice little game that social scientists talk about in order to illustrate the problem of free riding. The substantive issue is people free riding on other people's contributions, and then the contributions not coming since everybody behaves that way. Okay, the fifth idea is that unregulated markets intensify prisoners' dilemmas, intensify the problem of free riding. The kind of paradigmatic case of this is the exhaustion of fishing supplies. If you just let people fish as they wish and catch as many fish as they like in any body of water, it is virtually guaranteed you'll destroy the fishing stocks. We've done it in the North Atlantic. We're doing it in the Pacific. Fishing stocks get destroyed by the unregulated exercise of the individual right to fish. And that's because people want to free ride and not contribute to the common good of maintaining a collective fishery. Sixth idea, inequality, oppression, poverty. That's the kind of heading. Poverty in the midst of plenty is a modern tragedy because it constitutes avoidable suffering and perpetuates social cleavages and conflict. Poverty in the midst of plenty. That little phrase, you know, it's bumper sticker slogans. Poverty in the midst of plenty. That should be an affront to everybody. And again, I think the moral issues involved in this are really not a question of left and right. They really aren't. I mean, I assume that most conservative people also find poverty in the midst of plenty a moral affront, especially for children. Where we might differ is what we believe can be done about it, whether we believe there are collective solutions to these moral tragedies, or whether we believe only individual solutions are possible. Number 7, the incomplete revolutions of race and gender. There have been massive transformations towards equality, and those should not be minimized. They are historic achievements which constitute the world in which you are living and will enter when you finish school and form your families and live your lives, which make this remarkably different from 50 or 100 years ago. These are historic achievements, but they're combined with continuing forms of discrimination, some of which are extremely extremely pervasive and destructive and difficult to deal with. We should not be complacent about the continuing forms of discrimination, especially when they intersect class issues as well. The combination of continuing racism in the United States, the combination of that and its intersection with poverty creates a particularly pernicious form of ongoing oppression. 8th big idea around democracy. American democracy is real. It's not a fiction. But it's crippled by demand and resource constraints and by rules of the game which erode rule by the people. The attack on the affirmative state has further eroded American democracy. The kind of synoptic idea here is that American democracy is real but in jeopardy. Militarism. Militarism is an institution, not just a policy. It's an institution, not just a policy. The United States systematically uses military force to pursue its foreign policy objectives and does so more frequently than any other country in the world. That is a reality. And it's a system of interlocking interests and institutions that makes it very robust and very difficult to do anything dramatic about. And it stamps the nature of our domestic politics and not just our foreign policy. This is not to say, just to repeat a point, that I think the United States can do without a military, without a serious defense of our borders. But militarism as a pervasive orientation towards how we relate to the rest of the world, I believe is destructive both of our position in the world and destructive of our domestic priorities. Taxation. It's kind of odd, I suppose, on a list of what are the big ideas in a course on American society, to have one of them have the title taxation. This is clearly a bee in my bonnet. I doubt if very many people have asked what are the 12 most important ideas and issues that you think we should think about as we think about our society would list the problem of taxation on the list. Maybe these days there'd be more people. I think it's really central. And here's the big idea that I think you should at least take seriously, even if you don't fully agree with it. That taxes are the way of dividing up the total social production between public purposes and private purposes, between public purposes and private uses. Taxation should not be mainly thought of as the government taking things away from the people. Taxation is the way we, the people, divide up the totality of our production into public purposes and private purposes. Taxation is the mechanism for social allocation of resources, in which, because we're a market economy, it takes the form of taxing individuals, because that's how the income is generated, through private property and private payments to individuals. But that's simply because of the rules of the game. It's not some natural order of things in which, therefore, an alien power, the state, is taking stuff from you. We take stuff from our collective product and allocate it in different ways through the mechanism of taxation. Number 11, social institutions can be otherwise. We must reject TINA. TINA is an expression coined by Margaret Thatcher in the early 1980s. It means there is no alternative. We must reject TINA. I hope nobody in the class is named TINA. I definitely am not wanting to reject whoever that might be. Social institutions can be otherwise. They are not laws of nature. And finally, alternative futures. There are many possible futures. Human flourishing will be enhanced by extending and deepening democracy in egalitarian ways. These are all, in my view, desperately important issues. Whether you pursue sociology in the future, whether or not you become politically active, your lives are constantly being shaped by the forces we've been exploring in this class. There will be moments in the future where you will be called upon to make choices around these issues. It's unavoidable. There's no default option. You will be called upon to make choices, to weigh issues in light of the social pressures and dynamics and processes we've been studying. Whether in the ballot box, in your support of social movements, in how you raise your children, and how you contend with the hard choices of intimate life in terms of balancing career opportunities and priorities with personal relationships. My aspiration in this course throughout the semester has not been to convince you that my perspectives are the only or the best on every point, that I have the truth on every question we've been studying. I do hope that my ideas on capitalism, democracy, gender, race, class, and all the other topics make sense to you. I hope at least this doesn't seem like nonsense. At least it makes sense. I hope that most of you don't think what I've said should be rejected out of hand. And I don't mind if some of you agree with me. That would be nice. But that's not really the point. What I hope is that you've developed critical capacities to evaluate the kinds of arguments we've been exploring when you hear them from politicians, when you hear them from media pundits, and when you hear them from other professors, and that you use this to reflect on your own ideas, and you do so in a way that enables you to engage the world in a more constructive way. Thank you for a wonderful semester.
This course